This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
G'day and thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. It's Reconciliation Week and we talked to Aboriginal pastor and Kamilaroi man, Billy Williams, about what reconciliation means to him and how the church can play its part in it. Author Deborah Tidball shares her experiences of being in the sandwich generation, those in midlife who are dealing with the decline of their parents while also bringing up young children. She gives us some tips for making those nursing home visits work for everyone and shares the inspiration behind her book, When I See Grandma. Dr. Justin Colson wants to help you raise confident kids. This week he shares some common confidence crushes. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City shares the auntie perspective on doing family. And Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity reviews the Jeffrey Rush film The Book Thief, out now on DVD. And how is it that workers in the meat industry are better trained than those who care for our own flesh and blood? John Buchanan from the Workplace Research Centre at the University of Sydney says the childcare industry is undervalued and underfunded. That's all coming up on the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. It's Reconciliation Week this week. Probably the biggest step forward in recent times was Kevin Rudd's apology to the stolen generation. But where is reconciliation at now? And what's the role of the church in moving reconciliation forward? Pastor Billy Williams is a Kamilaroi man through Pastors Dion Church in North Brisbane. He's on the phone to share some thoughts about reconciliation. Good morning, Pastor Billy.
G'day, how you going?
Why does Australia need a Reconciliation Week? What does reconciliation mean to you and how do we achieve it?
Obviously, reconciliation is all about relationships, and it's probably easy to lose sight of that. In all of the statistics and all of the talk, it's easy to forget that we're really talking about people. And, of course, it's important to remember why relationships often don't work out. And, you know, it's actually pretty fundamental and pretty basic. And, of course, God's people should be at the centre of that to understand how that process works and what that really takes. Yeah, it is a very important thing.
Yeah, okay. And do you feel that Australia as a nation is currently moving forward with reconciliation?
Look, I think there's always opportunities for it. I mean, sometimes we make it to be this big thing, but because it's people on people, I mean, there's people reconciling today. There's people, you know, I'm in a car with a mate at the moment, and, you know, we're having chats and spending time together, and so there is. I mean, I think there are movements of people, but there's always difficulties and challenges in anything like that because we're talking about people. So
talking about spending time, is that one way that the church can, I guess, get better at reconciliation is just with people spending time together? In our church, we had a young boy come back. He just spent 2 weeks up in an Aboriginal community just south of Cairns, and he came back with a really different understanding of what Aboriginal culture is all about. Is that sort of part of the key to reconciliation, just that better understanding?
I'm pretty convinced it's that simple, that if reconciliation's about relationship and relationship's about people, then time is the essence of that, is the ability to spend time, to get to know others, to spend time, to listen to stories, to share stories and to make new stories, hopefully.
Yeah. And what do you think that Indigenous Australians can teach the broader church in terms of spirituality?
Well, spirituality is about relationship. And so, again, it was that same fundamental component. We're talking about exactly the same thing. And so at the essence of spirituality, at the essence of Aboriginality, is relationships. And, you know, that is exactly, you know, what we're talking about in this, reconciled relationships, about having functioning relationships, respectful relationships. I mean, that's the key, isn't it?
So, yeah. So it sounds like what you're talking about, it really is just like a one-on-one thing that we as people have to do, not something that's just up to the government.
Oh, absolutely. I think, unfortunately, we've probably tried to subcontract that stuff. We're waiting for the government to show us a lead in it. And, I mean, you know, we have an example in Christ who made it a very personal thing. He himself personalised relationship. He himself spoke about the individual responsibility in that. You know, if you've got something against your brother, go and see him. The difficulty in this is a lot of people don't know where to start, or we've made it this big, heavy, hard thing. And, of course, then when we're not quite sure what to do with it, we tend to want to run away from it or ignore it, or there's all sorts of things that happen then. But it's important that we do remember our role in it, our place.
Today's sorry day. How powerful is that word? It's a big part of the Christian faith, isn't it?
Oh, I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that there's an understanding of, you know, and there's all different levels and understandings of how we feel about that word, and how we engage with that word, but, you know, at the heart of it in terms of repentance and understanding that actions matter, that relationships matter.
I guess the thing that strikes me thinking about that concept of sorry is that normally in a relationship, you know, reconciliation comes when the person has to be led by the person who says sorry. But yet with reconciliation, often it's left to the Aboriginal people of Australia to kind of lead the way with reconciliation, almost like the responsibility falls to Aboriginal Australia to kind of lead. And yet normally in a relationship, it's normally the person who says sorry that has to, you know, show the lead. I wonder if that's something we've...
I hear what you're saying. Yeah, for sure. And I'll be delicate about that, because I think that is definitely true. I think what can often happen is we're waiting for the other person to show the initiative.
Yeah.
And it's important, even, I guess, I feel it, you know, even for Aboriginal people, that it's important that we don't stand back either on the way. So, you know, what does that mean for us individually and corporately as people, you know, that we don't, yeah, I think we can lose our way in that when it becomes like that.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for taking some time to have a chat and share some thoughts about what reconciliation really is.
Yeah, well, great. I appreciate the opportunity, and of course, you know, raising the awareness is a great, that's really what's behind the campaign and behind the initiative. And so for you to be able to talk about it today, hopefully it does raise people's attention and we look to engage in it.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much. It's Pastor Billy Williams. He's from Dion Church in North Brisbane. We've been talking about reconciliation for Reconciliation Week. I wonder if you've heard the expression, the sandwich generation. It refers to those people, often in their 40s, who are caring for both young children and their aging parents. While it can be a demanding time for those caught in the middle, it's also a challenge to bridge the communication gap between the little kids, who are rapidly developing their cognitive abilities, and the grandparent, who's slowly losing theirs. Deborah Tidball is the author of When I See Grandma, a new children's book that gives help and hope to children and parents coping with the mental decline of a grandparent. Welcome to the studio, Deborah.
Thanks, Katrina. It's great to be here.
What was it like for you while your children were little and your mother was declining with dementia? It must have been a hard time.
It is a hard time, Katrina. It was a hard time. It's one of those places where you think you're never going to actually meet the needs of anybody that you're looking after. So you're wanting to actually honour your parent and do as much care of them as you can. But also you've got little ones that you need to drag around everywhere after you as well. And you just feel like you're not doing a good job with anyone, really, and it's a tough time.
Yeah, I can imagine. An aged care facility can also be a difficult place for a kid, you know, to be faced with the end of life at such a tender age. How did your children cope with visiting their grandmother while she was in that state?
Katrina, it's actually fascinating taking the kids to see my mother when she was stayed in two particular aged care places. One of them was a low care place where she first was, and the other was high care when her needs became greater. And I guess When I See Grandma is more set in the high care facility, but it brought ideas from that we developed during the time Mum was in the low care place as well. And so my kids actually, once they realised that they could do little mini performances and things for my mother in the low care facility, and the others around would be watching, and they realised they had this audience already there that was appreciative regardless of the amateurness of their...
I'm sure their performances were wonderful, Deborah. Don't put them down.
How many times can you listen to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star stumbled over on the piano?
Well, these days they would be singing Let It Go from Frozen over and over again.
Exactly, exactly.
But did the elderly people appreciate having the children around?
It was just beautiful. And I think the thing that that my girls got out of that was a real sense of community in those places, and that even if grandma was sitting there not particularly responding, there was a host of other people who were. And even if they asked them the same questions over and over and over again, they were still appreciative, and the kids just thought that was fine. And I remember, you know, we would drive home in the car and the girls would be chatting to me about who they'd spoken to. You know, oh, what about Ivy, Mum? She's 94 and, you know, she keeps asking me the same questions, but, you know, she really likes me being here. And so it was just this sense of community that they had when they were there. So, and I guess that's what I wanted to see in When I See Grandma. I wanted to see that taking kids to an aged care facility is not just looking after the person that you're there to visit, but it's actually entering into a community. And they're bringing with them their vitality and their enthusiasm for life that these people just crave to see.
Mm-hmm. For someone who's in that same situation, and maybe they've just started on this road of trying to do these visits, what did you learn about how to make those visits easier and more meaningful for everyone?
Yeah. Part of what I wanted to show through When I See Grandma Again was that linking what the kids are doing now with who their grandmother is slash was, that they're seeing her at a particular time and they're not seeing her her through the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk a lot to them about her history, about the things she enjoyed, the choirs that she was in, the musical things she used to go to. My mother was actually an actress, and she was on the stage in England where she came from. And so, you know, telling the girls that, showing them photos, telling them stories, and connecting that with their everyday life.
So they get a picture of the full person, not just what the shell that's left.
Exactly.
Exactly. So in the book, you really beautifully do juxtapose, yeah, the reality of life now in the nursing home with the full and meaningful life that the grandmother in the story has lived. Maybe just read us a little bit from the book so we get a sense of that.
Sure. How about I start at the start? So this is narrated by a little girl, and she says, "I love going on walks with my family and pushing my baby brother in the stroller. He laughs when I go fast or push him over bumps. We walk to visit Grandma. It's sometimes sad to see her, but I'm always glad that I can brighten her dreams. When I see Grandma, I let the sun in for her dreams to shine on. I love singing in the school choir. The songs are happy and bright. Grandma loves singing too. When I see Grandma, I sing her a song for her dreams to dance on."
And in the illustrations, of course, we see Grandma much younger and, I guess, remembering. And what were you hoping, I guess, to say through that, or what feeling were you hoping to evoke through that sort of trip back down memory lane?
I think I was really wanting to get a message that the people who we're seeing have this rich history, that they are not, they're so much more than what we see when we're visiting, and that we can engage and connect our children with these stories of the past and with their with another generation, in fact, and that each of them can be showing love, that we can be sharing love across generations.
Yeah. The way you use the photos in the book as well is another really beautiful way of doing that. So
yeah. No, I was so pleased with the way that the illustrator, Lee Hedstrom, illustrated the book. She made beautiful use of the end pages with those old sepia-looking photos.
Lee is a great talent. I should just declare that Lee also illustrated my book, Marty's Not Free Party. So, you know, exactly. I'm a big fan of her work as well.
She's fantastic. And it just gave me so many goosebumps when she was showing me the roughs of the book, because so many of the things just paralleled my life and my family. I didn't actually meet Lee until after the book was done. And so it was just amazing that she illustrated the father figure in this. You look at him and you think, that's my husband.
Really?
She illustrated Grandpa and Grandma dancing during the war in uniform, and my mum met my dad when he was in the RAF. So there were just all these little things that sort of would give me goosebumps, and I go, oh, wow, that's just fantastic.
She does have an uncanny ability to get right to the heart of the text, doesn't she?
Incredible.
Yeah. So you've been blessed by that too.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, Deborah, for coming and sharing a bit of your story today, and I hope it's helped other people who are also in the sandwich generation right now and really feeling the pinch of that.
Great. Thanks, Katrina. And that's exactly why I wrote the book, because I thought it'd be great to have something like this when I was going through it with my girls. So I hope other people find it really encouraging.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. That's Deborah Tidball. She's the author of When I See Grandma, which looks at the issue of dementia and how it affects the whole family, especially young children. Still to come on the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast, how to raise confident kids, why abattoir workers are better trained than childcare workers, and a review of The Book Thief. Henry Ford famously said, "Whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right." Now, as parents, we would like to produce confident children, but we may be working against that without even realising it. Dr. Justin Colson has just published a new ebook called Creating Confident Kids: Scientific Strategies That Build Self-Belief in Our Children. So today we're going to talk about some of the things we adults do that work against our children's confidence. Hi, Justin.
G'day, Katrina.
Well, firstly, how do you define self-confidence, and why would we want kids to have it?
Really important question. Confidence, it comes from a Latin word, which is confidere, and it means that we have trust or faith in something. If we have self-confidence, therefore we have trust or belief in ourselves. And I think that's a pretty desirable thing. I think that that's something that we really want our kids to have. If they have self-belief, that means that when they're given challenging situations to deal with, that they'll believe that they can work a way through it. The other great thing about having that self-belief or that confidence is that every now and again our children might be put into situations where they're asked to do something they're not comfortable doing. We want them to have the confidence to say no. Similarly, sometimes they might be in a situation where everybody's too scared to do something. We want them to have the confidence to say yes. So confidence is one of those things that helps our children to make good decisions and act on them. And that's why I think we should all want to have confident kids.
Okay. Well, in your ebook, you describe 5 confidence crushes, things that parents do that literally crush their kids' confidence. Can you take us through a couple of those this morning?
Yeah, of course. There's 5 of them. I don't know if we'll have time to talk about them all, but let's go with number one. I think that the number one confidence crusher is when we just don't respond to our children, when we ignore them, when we don't show any interest in them. You know, they come home from school and they say, Mum, guess what? And we say, hang on a sec, I've just got to finish this level on Candy Crush.
As if, seriously. No, who would do that?
Well, I've seen some parents do that, but more to the point, sometimes we might say, not now, I'm on a phone call, or not now, I'm cooking dinner, or not now, I'm in the middle of something that's important. And quite often we're busy and what we're doing is important, but when we pervasively can't make time for our children, when we put their needs to one side so that we can look after ours, when we basically say, I'm not that interested in you, I'm focused on other things, we can really crush their confidence. And it can happen in really benign ways as well,
yeah,
as the more overt ways.
I mean, I laughed at the Candy Crush, but it could be that we're texting, that we're on Facebook, that we're doing something and not giving them the attention that they need. And that's, I guess, sending a message that, look, you're not as important as what's on Facebook.
That's exactly my point. It could even be as simple as, Dad, can you come and brush my teeth, or can you come and read me a story? No, not now. I've got to finish doing the dishes. You know, the dishes are important, but they're not as important. And when we pervasively put off time with our children and put off focus with our children so that we can do other things that we think are more important in the moment, we actually really crush our kids' confidence, and they withdraw within themselves and they ultimately stop coming to us.
Justin, is part of that, though, about how you communicate it? Because, I mean, sometimes we do have to finish a task. Is it when we just take a moment to stop and look at them and say, I understand you really want to read a story. We're going to do that in 5 minutes from now. Can you just wait 5 minutes? As opposed to going, no, I'm too busy, I can't do it.
That's exactly right. But many parents don't communicate that explicitly, Katrina.
Parents,
we get so caught up in what we're doing. We're really absorbed by it. And we just say, not now, I'm busy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's dismissive.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, and what's another, we've probably only got time for one more, but another way that we crush our kids' confidence without maybe realising it?
Well, I think that one that's probably a little bit, counterintuitive might be that we praise them all the time. It doesn't sound right that praising kids would crush confidence. I mean, praise is supposed to build self-belief. But we've got a couple of decades of really fascinating research now from a number of universities around the world that demonstrates pretty clearly that when we are praising our kids, we actually set them up to fail in a couple of ways. First of all, we can create praise junkies, which means that they feel really good when they're getting the praise, but if the praise stops, they automatically wonder if there's something the matter with them. For example, we might say, wow, that's such a beautiful picture you drew, aren't you? Such a great artist. But then they draw another picture, and because we don't make a big deal about it, they sort of go, well, maybe I'm not a great artist
after all.
The other challenge is when we, and I did an experiment on this when I was at the University of Queensland, had 100 people come into my lab, and I praised half of them for being really smart with some quizzes, and I didn't give any praise to the other half. Fascinating thing that happened was that the people who were praised, when they subsequently failed at another puzzle task, and then I asked them, what kind of puzzles would you like to do now? The people who had been praised consistently chose the easy ones. They were not motivated to take on challenge. They were struggling with their performance. They were struggling with their self-concept because I'd told them that they were smart and they'd failed and they started to question their own belief. They lost confidence because I'd praised them and then they'd had a subsequent setback. Praise can be and very often is a confidence crusher.
Interesting. So what's the alternative? We can't just leave it there. Let's come back next time and we'll talk about the clever ways to build confidence. Thank you, Justin.
My pleasure. Thanks, Katrina.
That's Dr. Justin Colson from happyfamilies.com.au. He's also the author of the ebook Creating Confident Kids, which is available at his website. Well, each week we catch up with Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City, and today to celebrate a much under-celebrated role, that of being auntie. Good morning, Joanna.
Morning, Katrina.
Were you excited when you first found out you were going to be an auntie?
I was very excited, yes. I was almost overwhelmed, actually, particularly when I finally got sent a photo post-birth, because my brother and sister-in-law lived quite far away from me.
Okay.
And seeing that blurry picture for the first time on the phone, I was just overwhelmed with joy and love. It was really exciting.
And how many nieces and nephews have you got now, Joanna?
Well, I have two. I've got one niece and one nephew, and they're 3 and 1. And they now live in Sydney, which is wonderful. So I got to hang out with them just on Saturday.
Okay. And what do you enjoy most about being an auntie?
Well, I think if you like rewound about 6 years, maybe 7 years, I would not have been looking forward to being an auntie at all. I didn't hang out with many kids. I'd been at a youth service at church for ages, so it had probably been a long time since I had to hang out with babies. And they were just a strange alien species.
I can relate to that. That's how I felt before I had my own too.
Yeah, and it's just like, yeah, that's great. And I've never been hugely interested in like kids ministry, even though I've done a fair bit of it, as you do. So, yeah, I don't think I would have been excited at all at that point if I'd been told, oh, you're going to be an auntie. But since that one was becoming part of church where I had the full age range again, so I sort of had to hang out with kids whether I liked it or not. And it was really helpful, actually, getting to know children and know about them. And, yeah, lots more people around me, including a lot of my friends, began to have kids. And it was really great just breaking down that scariness barrier a fair bit, to the point where, yeah, when I found out that I was going to be an auntie myself, I was pretty excited about that. And, yeah, I think I just really enjoy being able to be a part of their lives and see them grow. It's just a huge privilege to be able to pray for them and spend time with them. And I do enjoy being able to, whether it's with my actual niece or nephew or with many of the kids at church, just being able to help out their parents a bit by taking them off their hands for a little while. But the best thing about being an aunt is you get to give them back at the end.
That's true. Now, I think the inherent danger in the auntie role is that it can become a bit of slave labour. You know, I hate to say it, but, you know, the first person to be called on for babysitting duties or stuff like that. What do you find difficult about the auntie role? Because it's not the same for everyone, is it? Some people do it differently.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess, like, similar to the grandparent thing as well, that different people would have totally different expectations and ideas about what they would like and what the parents would like. As usual, it's another category where it's just really important to actually talk to each other. So I'm blessed and relieved, in a sense, that my brother and sister-in-law don't expect that I'm a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week babysitting service. But partly because I'd like to spend time with them as well and not just with the kids. So I think for me, one of the big things has been, whether it's with my own niece and nephew or with kids at church, I like to actually spend time with the parents as well as the child. And so even though I'm super happy to help out with things like babysitting or creche where I can, for me, it's not just, oh, yeah, I love spending time with kids. For me, I really like being able to help out the families in my life. And so if it's completely just separated from relationship to the parents, then, I just don't find that particularly encouraging at all.
So, yeah, right. So it's important that you're really included into the family and into the family occasions, not just kind of coming over and babysitting the kids while the parents go out and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And then you never actually see or relate to the parents at all. So, yeah, for me, that's the big thing, is just getting to know the whole family, and that helps it feel less like you're just a, you know,
a service, I guess.
Good tip. Don't use and abuse aunties, but include them in things, right?
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Thanks, Joanna.
That's a pleasure.
It's Joanna Hayes from the blog celibateinthecity.net. The Book Thief, starring Jeffrey Rush, is now out on DVD, based, of course, on the novel by Marcus Suzak. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity is on the line to review it. Good morning, Simon.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, I've heard rave reviews about this. Was it one that you enjoyed?
Yeah, I really did. The book is one of my favourites, so, you know, I'm always a bit nervous going to see the film of a loved book, but in this case, I think they did a really good job of it. It's a you know, brilliant story, beautiful story.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the story and the plot of the movie.
Yeah, well, the Book Thief is about really the people of a small German town in the 1930s and 40s. So just as, you know, Nazism is really ramping up and starting to kind of take over the village, and things are getting harder and harder for Jewish people. And the story centres around a little German girl, Liesl Memminger, who's been adopted into another family. So she's really lost her brother, then her dad's taken off, her mother's given her up to this other family. So she's in a really precarious situation. She comes into this town. She's met by a very, very kind, loving father, you know, father figure, foster figure. Jeffrey Rush plays that character. Mm. But a much tougher foster mum, who makes life pretty difficult for her. But that's the setup. You're getting things like book burnings and parades, and there's always pressure on families to conform to the Nazi push. You see this all this happening through the eyes of this little girl as she tells this story. And so it's really nicely told. She's taught to read by the Jeffrey Rush character, the father. His name's Hans, and she comes to absolutely love books and ends up kind of stealing, if you like, or borrowing books from the library of the mayor of the town. And so there's this nice thing about reading and the things that she learns from that. And within that whole thing, a very important part of this plot is the family are hiding a Jewish young man, Max, in their basement. They do this for years, and so she gets to know him, and she reads to him. He's very sick, and as he's recovering in that sickness, she's reading to him and sort of getting to know him. And so that's the setup of the story, and there's a whole lot of events that occur around that.
Well, it sounds like a story that could touch on some pretty powerful themes. I mean, that one obviously seems like the power of stories to sustain people, but also there's personal risk in standing up for what you believe in. What sort of comes through most strongly in the film?
Yeah, you're right. There are lots of really interesting themes. That idea of sacrifice is huge. So the family here put themselves at great risk to protect this Jewish man, a young guy who's in their basement. And so there's all this sort of fear around what might happen if he's caught. And they, of course, would be in great danger if he was. But there's this sense that even though they're not heroic people, like they're scared of the consequences, but they know that this is the right thing to do. Mm. So they're determined to protect this life that they have in their care, and that the whole family, including Lisa, are kind of in on this, and they resist any kind of push to let him go, even though it puts them at great risk. And I think that's a really powerful message for all of us. Plenty of us would feel, we'd like to think we'd be doing that sort of thing when the moral choices are that stark, but the pressure to conform is very, very powerful, and you can understand when some people aren't able to sort of do that. But so that's a great theme of this.
And how does the movie portray childhood or the value of childhood and what children bring to the world? Because I know that Marcus Suzak, the author of this book, has such a deep respect for childhood. Does that come across in the film?
Oh, it really does. So it's, you know, this Liesl is the key character, and you see everything through her eyes. There's a kind of convention in some film and literature of this all-knowing child. Not quite like that, but you definitely get this sense of the children, and especially Liesl in this case, can see things more clearly than the adults. Mm. They're subject to the world of adults, so she's sort of restricted in what she can do, but she ends up making a real difference. So there's a sense that the children in this story have agency. They're able to make a difference. Certainly Liesl is able to. And so, yeah, there is a real respect for that, and definitely in the sense that it's the children that see in a way that the adults cannot.
Yeah.
And it's a beautifully told story in that way.
That's a good I guess, concept for kids to be exposed to, but there's also some pretty serious things that happen in this movie. Do you think it is appropriate for kids to watch?
It's a heartbreaking story, no doubt about that. But it's subtle in the way it's told. A lot of the violence is more implied than actual. So, yeah, I actually think it's a great family film. But maybe 10 years up, 10 years, 12, my kids are still that age, I reckon I could watch it with them.
Yep.
And a really great family film because it does introduce you to an important story, but also some really great themes and that you could talk with them about.
Yeah, it sounds like one to watch and talk through together. Thanks so much for reviewing it for us today. It sounds like you pretty strongly recommend it, Simon.
No, I really do. It's a good film.
That's great. That's Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity, and we've been talking about The Book Thief starring Geoffrey Rush. Who would you want to be better equipped for their job? The person who slaughters the cow you're going to serve for dinner, or the person who takes care of your own flesh and blood while you're at work? Sydney Uni researchers have found that the quality of training received by childcare workers is less consistent than the training given to abattoir workers. John Buchanan is the director of the Workplace Research Centre at the University of Sydney. G'day, John.
Good afternoon.
Now, how different are the standards between these two industries when it comes to workplace training?
Look, the first thing to keep in mind is that this isn't a reflection on the workers involved. Most people in childcare are really kind, caring and professional people.
Oh, I absolutely love the ones at my daughter's daycare, yes.
Yeah. And this is a reflection on how our society is geared up in supporting the development of skill and the support it provides to people mastering their crafts. Now, there's significant variability in the childcare sector. And that's our key finding. Whereas in the meat processing sector, there are major pressures from export. There are major issues of health in terms of contamination and the like, which leads to a very high standard of basic training and support on the job.
So it's really that export-driven industry that's pushed the abattoir industry to become a leader in this area. Is that it?
A big part of it. And the industry has taken a very disciplined approach. It has a central training body called MINTRAC, the Meat Industry Training Advisory Council, and they have significant buy-in from nearly all the meat processing employers. Now, the childcare industry is far more fragmented. The sector has been seriously underfunded for a long time. Governments have walked away from taking responsibility, and under those conditions, there's been a burgeoning private sector. Now, some private providers are exceptional, but there are other providers who are looking to get away with the minimum possible. This is where I think the big problem comes from. The meat industry has said, we're going to take a stance and we're going to try and improve quality across the board. It's the variability issue that's the key one.
So what would need to happen for the childcare industry, it sounds bizarre to say this, but to reach the standard of the meat industry?
Two things. They've got to become better coordinated. There's a lot of people in childcare. There are a lot of representative bodies. They don't speak with one voice, and that fragmentation limits their capacity to reach consistency on what they think the core standards are. But let's be quite clear that the fundamental problem with childcare is that it's not funded properly. If you were trying to run a school in the way you ran a childcare centre, you'd be, run out of town. Early childhood education is not taken nearly as seriously as school education. But all the neuroscience basically shows that money spent in the first 3 or 4 years of life easily pays for itself over time by producing healthier and more competent individuals.
So does this all mean that Australian childcare isn't as good as it should be or could be?
Absolutely. No. Look, and childcare's just taken another hit with the budget. You know, the government's taking even more money out of it. In the past, care for infants has been regarded as women's work, and we actually haven't thought through what it means. As more women go back into the paid workforce, there's a need for professional childcare services and, early childhood education. Because of that, we as a society haven't really come to grips with the fact that we've got to run these as professional services, treat the people in those sectors seriously, not as kind of people who are backfilling behind mothers or dads who aren't staying at home. Mm. They're actually integral to the way in which we live life these days. Until we get that broader social valuation, the poor old childcare workers are not going to get properly paid, and their training arrangements are not going to be as good as they could be.
So what needs to change? Are you saying that we need more government funding?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, as a society, let's be clear. The average Australian worker now produces twice as much per hour as they did 30 years ago, right? We've had huge improvements in productivity. We have abundance of a kind that people of two or three generations ago would not have dreamed possible. So it's not a matter that the resources aren't there, it's how they're distributed. And I would have thought that care for the young is probably just as important as care for the old and infirm. But until we start to make that kind of valuation, poor old childcare is going to be the second cousin.
So what can we do about it?
Well, I think it's really important that you know, people like yourselves are getting the arguments out there and giving me a chance to get these arguments out there. But I think people have got to start campaigning more generally. They shouldn't take these kind of budget cuts to childcare lying down. I think people suffer in silence. You know, I don't think silence is the answer here. I think we've got to be more vocal. It's not just looking after the kids, it's looking after our futures. You know, healthy kids today mean a lot stronger future tomorrow, and if we don't campaign like that, we're just weakening our futures.
Yeah, absolutely. And while many of us who have great childcare are extremely grateful, everybody should have that opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's John Buchanan. He's the director of the Workplace Research Centre at the University of Sydney.